This is lecture 7 in the series on model leadership. And the model we're looking at today is the careful timekeeper. And you might want to imagine here a man with a stopwatch. Time is far more valuable than money. It's far more limited and far more difficult to recover when lost. We're going to look first of all today at a theology of time. Then we'll look at the dangers of time. Thirdly, we'll look at the management of time. And then, after we've looked at that, we'll look at two kinds of life: the well-planned life and the summoned life. So first of all, a theology of time. Firstly, God gives time, James 1:17. We do not deserve a second of time in this world. Through sin, we have forfeited our right to exist. Therefore, every moment of life is a gift of God. If a man were standing beside me, giving me a dollar bill every second or every minute, I would love him. But God is standing beside us and giving us something far more valuable than dollars. He's giving us the seconds, the minutes, and the hours themselves. So God gives time. Secondly, God gives enough time. John 11, verse 9. We sometimes say, I just don't have enough time. I know we're rarely saying it as a complaint against God, but it does reflect upon God. If someone gave you 100 tasks to do in 1 minute, you'd view that person as unjust and unfair. It's simply not enough time. But God has given us enough time to do all that he requires of us in this world. He is not unfair or unjust. Perhaps, as we shall see, your perceived lack of time is due to doing more than God requires of you. Thirdly, God gives limited time. Psalm 90, verse 10. We have a limited time on this earth. Our arrival and departure times are on God's timetable. However long it may be, it does have a limit that we shall not pass. Fourthly, God judges our use of time. Romans 14, 12. We're used to the idea of God judging our words or our use of money. But the idea of God watching over our use of time is not often at the forefront of our thoughts. Words are audible, money is visible, but time seems so much more nebulous, so much more difficult to get a hold of. Yet, as it is his gift, we will be called to give an account for our use of it. Fifthly, God commands us to redeem time, Ephesians 5:16. To redeem a person means to act to secure a captured person's rescue by paying a price. To redeem time, therefore, means to act to secure the recovery of wasted time by paying a price. And that price, as we shall see, is self-discipline and self-denial. So there's a very brief theology of time. God gives time. God gives enough time. God gives limited time. God judges our use of time. And God commands us to redeem time. Let's look secondly at the dangers of time. There are three sins we can fall into in our use of time. The first is time wasting. This hardly needs amplification. It's simply letting time slip through our hands without using it productively. And it's especially easy for a pastor to fall into this, as he has no time clock or boss to check how he is using his time. And time can be wasted in various ways. Laziness, for example. We simply go about our business too slowly, too half-heartedly. Disorganization. We may be running around, but we're running around as headless chickens because our studies, our finances, our administration, our libraries, etc. are just a mess. There's inefficiency. We may not be using the technological tools to simplify tasks. We phone when we should email. We use Strong's Concordance rather than Bible software. We write out things by hand again and again and again rather than using a word processor. We try to study for sermons in the afternoon when we are sleepy rather than first thing in the morning. We read where there are lots of distractions rather than where we can really concentrate and so on. There's so much inefficiency sometimes in our use of time. Then there's indiscipline. We too easily choose to surf the internet rather than study a text. We spend too long on the phone to friends when there are people to visit in hospital. We fail to plan the week or our day and end up aimless or simply reacting to the demands of others. So in all these ways we can waste time. Laziness, disorganization, inefficiency, and indiscipline. But in addition to time wasting, another danger is time stretching. And this involves lengthening our days, our working hours, so that we can do more and more work. Psalm 127, verse 2 addresses this and calls it vain. Partly because when we stretch our hours, we often simply stretch our work to fill the hours rather than pack more in to these hours. Again, this is so easy for pastors to do, as we have no fixed hours. We can start stretching our hours, and yet we are not getting more done. We're just taking longer to do it. Isn't it amazing how quickly you can prepare a sermon when you have a deadline? So set yourself office and working hours, let your wife and family know them, and try to stick with that and avoid time stretching. Then the third danger, in addition to time wasting and time stretching, is time squeezing. And this happens when we have so much to do that we do nothing well. We try to squeeze so much into the day that we squeeze the quality out of our work and also the joy and satisfaction out of our work. We aim too high, spend our day stressed, and end up looking back dissatisfied at all we were not able to do. We can sin by doing too little, but we can also sin by attempting to do too much. Always strikes me when reading the Gospels that there didn't seem to be any sense of rush about the Lord's life. He seemed to be largely unhurried, calm, peaceful, yet he never sinned sins of omission. So that brings us to the management of time. We've looked at a theology of time and the dangers of time. Now, this is the vast majority of this lecture. We're going to look at the management of time. And it's really in view of our theology of time and the dangers that faces in our use of time, we have to have a plan for managing our time. And I don't know, I call this Murray Minute Management. I'm going to give you 10 points here. They all start with P. First of all, peace. The most important time of the day is first thing in the morning. Get up early enough to have a quiet time for reading the Bible and prayer. Those first moments of peaceful orientation of the mind and soul are the foundation of a successful day of ministry. And the key to getting up early enough is getting to bed early enough the night before. If you're finding it impossible to get up early enough for an undistracted time of worship and reading your Bible, then you're going to bed too late. The success of the day really depends largely on the amount of sleep you get. I prefer personally to have a shower before I read and pray, as it helps to wake me up. A cup of coffee is also an essential and pleasant companion. Just find what works best for you and stick with it, but get that peace first thing in the morning. Secondly, plan. I'm going to deal with organization and administration in more detail in the next lecture. However, some overlap here can do no harm. After your quiet time, use paper, a whiteboard, or electronic means to list all the things you have to do in the day. Or ideally, pick up the list you prepared the day before. Someone once said that for every minute spent in organizing, an hour is earned. Well, that's a slight exaggeration, but a lot of time is saved if we pause to get organized rather than just plunge into the first thing that comes to mind. And make sure you have only one to-do list. I keep that list with me all the time and keep adding to it. Some items are for that day and other items will be for the future, but everything that needs to be done goes on that list. I try not to carry anything about with me in my head. Thirdly, prioritize. You're not going to get everything done, so you have to let the less important things wait. Organize the list of to-dos into the following categories. First of all, urgent. There may be phone calls, visits, or emails that simply have to be done that day. Secondly, big. Make sure you do something substantial in the study each day. It may be a few hours on a sermon, or a few hours writing an article, or a few hours of focused study on some subject. It's very easy in the ministry to let the little things squeeze out the big. The little things are less demanding on the mind and soul, and give a sense of, I'm getting things done. But time must be set apart for the longer term substantial things. It's usually best to do this first thing in the morning after devotions. Thirdly, there are daily things. There are some routine things that happen every day or should do. They're not urgent and the world won't fall apart if you don't do them, but if you let them build up, then you will eventually become overwhelmed. Some examples may be email inbox to zero, non-urgent phone calls, organizing your diary, coordinating your diary with your wife, balancing bank accounts, backing up data, or for myself, I use Dropbox. So the daily, the routine things are the third category. The fourth category are visits and meetings. Are there any pastoral visits or meetings planned for that day? If so, work out the most efficient way of combining these to minimize travel time. What other errands can I do on these trips? Then the last category is long term. So you've got urgent, big, daily, visits and meetings, long term. Eventually, you'll be asked to write articles, review books, contribute to reports, deliver lectures, etc. Try to find one slot in the week that you dedicate to these more long-term projects. It's usually best to schedule these projects for completion every 2 to 3 weeks, rather than let them build up on you so that you have five to do in 2 days' time. If you don't schedule it, it won't get done. Andrew Carnegie once asked a consultant, "What can you do for me about time control?" The consultant said, "I'll make one suggestion and you send me a check for what you think it's worth. Write down what you have to do on a piece of paper in order of priority and complete the first item before you go on to the second." Well, it's reported that Carnegie tried this for a few weeks and sent him a check for $10,000. So we must prioritize. Our fourth P is pick. Pick the right time for the right tasks. 80% of your results are achieved by 20% of the things that you do. That's a famous business equation. If you don't set aside time for tasks, they are unlikely to be done. Make sure you choose the right time slot for each task and allocate enough time for it. Devote large blocks of time to important tasks. Squeeze less important tasks into smaller blocks and consolidate smaller tasks into one block to release larger blocks of time. In other words, grab a number of small things, do them in this one block, rather than spread these little things throughout the day. And that leaves you with the big blocks for the big things. And don't multitask. Glenn Stansbury says, every time you switch your attention, there's a cognitive ramp-up time. It can range from a few seconds to a few minutes. So if you constantly cycle between checking email, instant messaging, Twitter, text, voicemail, calendars, BlackBerry's apps, scores, stock quotes, news, current projects, and more, then respond to each, the time you lose to incessant ramp up becomes substantial. Instead, Minimize time lost to non-stop cognitive ramping by batching your time and focusing on individual categories of tasks with intense bursts of attention. You should try to see time, to visualize time by maybe blocking out a wall planner or diary with different colors. Julie Morgenstern talks about this in her book on time management. She compares what a cluttered schedule looks like as opposed to an organized schedule. The cluttered schedule makes it difficult to see what you have to do and when you have to do it. The latter, an organized schedule, removes guesswork, it's orderly and helps you to see what's to be done at a glance. And it's also easier to see when you've reached capacity. So pick the right time for the right tasks. Fifthly, perform. Now, you'll see what we've been doing here. We started with peace. And then we need a plan, listing all the things we have to do. Then we prioritize these things. What must be done? What's urgent? What's big? Etc. Then, when we've settled the things we have to do and the order in which we have to do them, we pick the right times for the right tasks. But all this really is in the planning stage, and we must come to this fifth P, that is perform. And I want to speak here a little bit about the common problem of procrastination. Andrew Carnegie said, "No unwelcome task becomes any the less unwelcome by putting it off until tomorrow." So you see, it's not just Christians who see the devastating effects of procrastination. That's derived from a Latin word meaning to put off for tomorrow. In fact, numerous scholars have contributed to a recent book about it called The Thief of Time. And at $55, it probably won't be near the top of our book buying priorities, but the New Yorker magazine has done us a favor with an extensive review. They summarized it as, first of all, procrastination is painful. Undone items on our to-do list gnaw at our consciences for weeks and even months. Why do we avoid unpleasant tasks when the act of avoidance only increases our discomfort? Secondly, it's costly. Procrastination makes business lose money. Alec Taylor's recent history of GM, 60-0, highlights how key executives delayed inevitable decisions. So procrastination makes businesses lose money, but it also makes pastors lose credibility. Thirdly, it's irrational. Pierce Steele defines procrastination as willingly deferring something even though you expect the delay to make you worse off. Samuel Johnson said, "I could not forbear to reproach myself for having so long neglected what was unavoidably to be done, and of which every moment's idleness increased the difficulty." It's irrational. Fourthly, it thrives in vagueness. David Allen of Getting Things Done fame insists on clear and concrete task lists. He says the vaguer the task or the more abstract the thinking it requires, the less likely you are to finish it. Fifthly, it feeds on perfectionism. Procrastinators are always waiting for the perfect time. General McClellan's excessive planning and preparation infuriated President Lincoln during the Civil War. He was always asking for more troops, more weapons, more time to plan the ideal battle. It feeds on perfectionism. Sixth, it picks the easy route. In an experiment, people were asked to pick one movie to watch that night and one to watch at a later date. Not surprisingly, for the movie they wanted to watch immediately, people tended to pick lowbrow comedies and blockbusters. But when asked what movie they wanted to watch later, they were more likely to pick serious, important films. The problem, of course, is that when the time comes to watch the serious movie, another frothy one will seem more appealing. Seventhly, procrastination often arises when we have too much to do, When we're overwhelmed with to-dos, we often feel there is no single to-do worth doing. Eighthly, it's increasing. According to Pierce Steele, a business professor at the University of Calgary, the percentage of people who admitted to difficulties with procrastination quadrupled between 1978 and 2002. In that light, it's possible to see procrastination as the quintessential modern problem. Well, Gretchen Rubin of Happiness Project fame gives six tips for forcing yourself to tackle a dreaded task. Firstly, she says, do it first thing in the morning. One of her 12 commandments is, do it now. No delay is the best way. Secondly, if you find yourself putting off a task that you try to do several times a week, do it every day. So, for example, if you're finding it hard to go for a walk 4 times a week, try going every day. Thirdly, have someone keep you company. Studies show that we enjoy practically every activity more when we're with other people. Fourthly, make preparations. Assemble the proper tools. Clean off your desk. Get the phone number. Find the file. She says that she often finds that when she's dreading a task, it helps her to feel prepared for it. Fifthly, commit. We've all heard the advice to write down our goals, and so she says on the top of a piece of paper, write, by the end of today, April 7, I will have da 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 da. In other words, give yourself a deadline. Sixthly, remind yourself that finishing a dreaded task is tremendously energizing. Studies show that hitting a goal releases chemicals in the brain that give you pleasure. If you're feeling blue, although the last thing you feel like doing is something you don't feel like doing, push yourself and do it, and you'll get a big lift from it. Some other helps are reward yourself. If I do this today, I'll buy a book on Amazon this evening. Or break down huge tasks into smaller steps. Instead of saying, oh, I've got a book to write today, say, I will write 2 paragraphs today. So, perform is my fifth P. Sixth P is pace. Some pastors live life at Wall Street trader pace. Others go for the let it all hang out pace. Neither helps the pastor or his people. Somewhere between these two poles is where we should find ourselves, and it will vary from person to person. Find a pace that allows you to get a good amount of substantial work done, and yet that will allow you to have time for people, and they are not afraid to ask you for time. Set yourself time limits on work like sermons. You can spend an endless amount of time perfecting a sermon. You have to draw a line somewhere, so that you have time to do other duties. You also have to be able to distinguish between tasks that require a much higher quality of work than others. For example, a sermon for a nursing home on a Sunday afternoon does not require as much preparation as the main preaching sermon of the week. Pace your to-do list as well. If you have 10 extra things to do this week, then do 2 a day rather than try to do 10 on day one. That breaks up the mountain into smaller, manageable steps. One way to speed up the pace at which you do mundane tasks, if not all tasks, but certainly mundane tasks like, say, email, is to use a stopwatch or a timer. Pace is the best place I can find also to mention exercise. Glenn Stansbury said, "It sounds counterintuitive, but you have to spend time exercising. Research has shown that exercise boosts cognitive function, creativity, problem solving, and productivity. In fact, a NASA study showed employees who exercised daily worked at 100% efficiency after 7 hours, while those who didn't exercise saw a 50% drop. Meaning it took them twice as long to accomplish the same thing." So exercise, in effect, creates time. And build in buffer time so that you've space to accommodate if something interrupts or goes wrong. If you don't and something sets you off schedule, then it will be impossible to get back on track and you'll lose momentum. And get enough sleep also, it really helps boost your memory. Seventh P is purge. One of the benefits of the time management exercise that we did in class is that you'll hopefully have identified a number of time wasters in your life. Probably just the exercise of recording your time was revealing to you and had its own corrective effects. There's no question that the biggest drain on pastors' time now is the internet, and you'll have to find a way of controlling this, either through self-discipline or more likely with the help of time clocks and filters and blockers. So purge out time wasters. Eighthly, protect. According to Julie Morgenstern, the average information worker is interrupted by another person or by technology every 11 minutes. And it takes 25 minutes to refocus to the same extent. So if you're ever going to get quality study time and sermon preparation time, you will have to protect the time you set aside to do this. Mark out study appointments in your schedule as if you are visiting with someone and make it non-negotiable. I found the mornings were the best for this. I usually protected 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. I protected the time by informing my elders of my study time, which also percolated into the congregation. I put the phone on the answering machine. I shut down email. Made a point of returning all phone calls at lunchtime. You've got to balance accessibility with productivity. My wife liked to bring me coffee mid-morning and sit a bit and chat, but when I started making coffee in my own study and having some snacks in my drawer, I found myself able to accomplish much more. You'll want to have a notebook nearby you as you study, to jot down to-do and other thoughts that occur while you're preparing sermons so that you don't think, oh, I better do that before I forget it. No, just write it down. Ninthly, pause. Pastors need a Sabbath, just like everyone else, a time to take a break from work, to take time out for yourself and your family. When we homeschooled, I took off every Monday. My wife was very strict about this. Only twice did I persuade her that I really needed the extra day to work. In both cases that I worked Mondays, I accomplished no more by the end of the week than if I had taken the time off and rested. So take a Sabbath. Tenthly, price. I really hope that this has convinced you of the need to value time far more highly than you have in the past, and to realize as you get older, the value of time only increases. So, we've looked at 10 Ps in the Murray Minute Management Plan. Peace, plan, prioritize, pick, perform, pace, purge, protect, pause, and price. I want to finish by looking at two kinds of life, two kinds of life. New York Times columnist David Brooks recently wrote about two ways of thinking about life, the well-planned life and the summoned life. Let's look at the well-planned life first of all. Brooks's presentation of the well-planned life leaned heavily on a 2010 Harvard commencement address given by Clayton Christensen, a Harvard Business School professor and a serious Christian. Yep, that's right, a serious Christian at Harvard Business School. Brooks underlines Christensen's Christian commitment by narrating how he refused to play college sports on a Sunday. But Brooks says Christensen combines a Christian spirit with business methodology. He says, in plotting out a personal and spiritual life, he applies the models and theories he developed as a strategist. He emphasizes finding the right metrics, efficiently allocating resources, and thinking about marginal costs. When he's done, life comes to appear as a well-designed project, carefully conceived in the beginning, reviewed and adjusted along the way, and brought toward a well-rounded fruition. Christensen observed how high achievers usually misallocate their resources. If they have a spare half hour, they use it to produce some tangible result at work, like closing a sale, writing a blog, etc., rather than invest time and energy in far more important things like family relationships, which may not yield results until 20 years later. Christensen's advice? Invest a lot of time when you are young in finding a clear purpose for your life. When I was a Rhodes Scholar, he recalls, I was in a very demanding academic program, trying to cram an extra year's worth of work into my time at Oxford. I decided to spend an hour every night reading, thinking, and praying about why God put me on this earth. That was a very challenging commitment to keep, because every hour I spent doing that, I wasn't studying applied econometrics. I was conflicted about whether I could really afford to take that time away from my studies, but I stuck with it and ultimately figured out the purpose of my life. Having done that, he says, you're then able to make the right decisions about time management and talent multiplication. The well-planned life. But David Brooks then goes on to describe the summoned life, a life lived from an entirely different perspective. He says life isn't a project to be completed. It's an unknowable landscape to be explored. A 24-year-old can't sit down and define the purpose of life in the manner of a school exercise because she's not yet deep enough into the landscape to know herself or her purpose. So, instead of plotting a course like a strategic planner, we should wait for the course to unfold and respond accordingly. Brooks says, the person leading the summoned life starts with a very concrete situation. I'm living in a specific year in a specific place facing specific problems and needs. At this moment in my life, I'm confronted with specific job opportunities and specific options. The important questions are, what are these circumstances summoning me to do? What is needed in this place? What is the most useful social role before me? Such questions can only be answered by sensitive observation and situational awareness, not calculation and long-range planning. In America, he says, we've been taught to admire the lone free agent who creates new worlds, but for the person leading the summoned life, the individual is small and the context is large. Life comes to a point not when the individual project is complete, but when the self dissolves into a larger purpose and cause. Brooks says that the more individualistic, well-planned life is more American, whereas the more social, summoned life is common elsewhere. So which is best? Well, in Brooks' predictable, moderate style, he comes down firmly on the fence by concluding, but they are both probably useful for a person trying to live a well-considered life. However American or un-American these two ways of living are, is not the most important question for us. Rather, we should be asking which is the most biblical. The person who lives a well-planned life, he takes time to find a clear life purpose, then make appropriate decisions about how to spend their time and use their talents. The person who lives a summoned life, who rejects the possibility of long-term planning, but as situations and circumstances arise, they ask, what are these circumstances summoning me to do? In fact, I think it would be more accurate to call this the reactive life. So what's best? The well-planned life or the reactive life? Well, I believe that every Christian should live a well-planned life. No Christian should be just a victim of events, a helpless cork tossed to and fro on the ever-changing ocean of circumstances and other people's expectations. We must take the time to prayerfully seek a life purpose. God put each of us here for a specific reason, and we shouldn't just drift from day to day, from week to week, from year to year, frittering away precious time without any sense of direction. We must take our time and our talents to God and ask Him what He will have us to do, and wait for His guidance. And that simple act would save so many Christians from many years of pointless ping-ponging around from job to job, from passion to passion, from person to person, from place to place. However, there are dangers in the well-planned life, especially in the selfish neglect of important relationships, as Brooks also hinted at. The person living the well-planned life can become insensitive to circumstances, events, and people around him. I don't care if my neighbour is sick, I have a plan and I'm sticking to it. He can become frustrated with anyone and anything that interrupts his plan or renders his day inefficient. He can become deaf to God's voice speaking to him through his word and through providence as his life unfolds. While he may have got his life plan from God, he may neglect to get his everyday plan from God. Everyone needs to allow an element of reactive life in their life. So, I suppose I'm joining David Brooks in the fence. However, I'm definitely falling over on the well-planned life side, as I believe it's more biblical than the reactive life. Consider Christ's life. He didn't get up every day and wonder, what am I doing here or where am I going? No, he had a very definite life plan. Maybe we should say death plan, which he received from his father. However, he also had the right balance between the well-planned life and the reactive life. While there were times when he would not be deflected by people's demands and the pressure of unpredicted events, there were other times when he did respond to pressing need and urgent circumstances. Now, if I can apply this especially to pastors, I would say that too many pastors live a reactive life. We often go from day to day, just responding to events, phone calls, emails, and others' agendas. We may have a weekly plan that involves preparing two or three sermons. However, we don't usually think much further ahead than that. I would really encourage pastors to think more long-term, not just about their congregation, but about their own lives. Take your time, your talents, your interests, and your schedule to the Lord and ask Him to help you plan a long-term project. It might be to master Greek or Hebrew, to research a favourite subject, or to do a THM or DMin, or write a book, or evangelise a particular place or group of people, or mentor a young man, etc. But prayerfully pick a project and allocate fixed and non-negotiable time to it every week. Let your family and elders know your plan and seek their cooperation. The person who lives the well-planned life is better equipped to react to the unplanned events of life. I suppose, in conclusion, whatever way we live, it has to be a prayerful life. I believe we do need time. We do need to take time out to ask what God would have us to do, not just for today, but also for the longer term. So maybe the equation should be something like 70% well-planned life, plus 30% reactive life, plus 100% prayerful life. Now that doesn't make logical sense, does it? Doesn't make mathematical sense. But I think it does make spiritual sense.